Okay, so today is the 24th Derech Hashem class, and it's May 14th, 5772, that's 2012, the 37th day of the Omer. And we're starting in the second section of Derech Hashem, third chapter, and we're going to do, hopefully, to the end of the chapter, 9, 10. Oh, no, we're not at 9. We're at 10. 10, 11, and 12 is what I'm hoping for. Okay, so tonight's big subject, then, is reincarnation. So paragraph 10 says, and I'll just read you the first part, there's another important principle regarding God's providence. God arranged matters so that man's chances of achieving ultimate salvation should be maximized, as discussed earlier. Let's just see what the word ultimate salvation is. Let's see. It says Hatzalah, which I guess could be translated as salvation. Lehibar laharbot od ha-Hatzalah, kamoshe zacharnu. Okay, a single soul can be reincarnated a number of times in different bodies, and in this manner it can rectify the damage done in previous incarnations. Similarly, it can also achieve perfection that was not attained in its previous incarnations. The soul is then ultimately judged at the end of all of these incarnations. Its judgment will depend on everything that took place in all its incarnations, as well as its status as an individual in each one. Okay, so reincarnation is a strong principle, excuse me, in Judaism, but not everybody accepts it. So that's important to know, that when we're learning the Ramchal, we're learning probably the most accepted theory of how things work, and we do understand that, as we discussed in the first class, which I don't think either of you were there for, but that the Ramchal did receive, he did receive some special teaching, it seems, from Malachim, possibly from Eliyahu. It seems pretty clear that he was educated not just by human beings, but by something else as well, or some things else, which he writes in letters to people, and it's one of the reasons that people were very nervous about him and why he was put into Chayrim. His writing was put into Chayrim. But now with the 2020 hindsight that we have, the whole Jewish world pretty much accepts the theories of the Ramchal. But it is important to understand that what's being written isn't hard and fast. It doesn't mean that that's for sure always the way it is. But this this is a strong explanation of how things are, and it seems to be, at this point, the most accepted one at this point in Jewish history. Pardon?
Who doesn't accept it?
Who doesn't accept it? I'm not sure. I bet I'm guessing, and I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing that perhaps the Rambam doesn't. The Ramchal's philosophy is more like the Ramban's. The Rambam is more of a rationalist, and he doesn't agree with everything that's here. So I don't know enough who doesn't, but I know that it's not fully accepted as a concept across the entire Jewish spectrum, but that in general today it seems to be pretty accepted. And also, for instance, in general today, we have the concept of Hashgacha Pratis, of God's intimate involvement with our daily life and everything that occurs in it. That's also not accepted by everybody in the broad spectrum of accepted Jewish philosophy and philosophers. But that is the accepted concept today, that God is intimately involved in everything that happens, and that's also according to the Ramban and according to the Ramchal. And while the Rambam does believe in Hashgacha Pratis, he does not believe in as intimate an interaction as these teachers teach. So some people mistakenly believe that the Rambam does not believe in Hashgacha Pratis at all, that he only holds by Hashgacha Klolis, which we'll discuss at another time what that means, but that's not the accepted concept today in the general Jewish world, with strong concepts of Hashgacha Pratis. I'm not exactly sure what turns those wheels, why we, the big we of the Jewish community at large, meaning the Jews who believe at large, because it doesn't actually count. It's interesting. We often do go by, in a way, a majority rules, except for the majority that rules is always the majority of people who are striving to keep the Torah. So while today the majority of Klal Yisrael is not Shomer Shabbos, that does not take away the rules of Shabbos. So even though the majority of Jews certainly don't believe in Hashgacha Pratis like this, but that doesn't take away the fact that that's the way we hold. So the we of the we hold is the we of those who are striving to keep Torah and Mitzvahs, to live their lives guided by that. Even if we make mistakes, if we stumble and fall, even if we're not so educated, but the we is the group of people who strive to inform our lives with it, even though that's actually a minority of the Jewish people today, unfortunately. But reincarnation seems to be a strong concept these days, so the Ramchal is discussing it. So I asked Rabbi Jonathan Rieti a little bit about reincarnation at one point, and it seems that reincarnation is not preferred, not comfortable at all. And so many books, even books by people who do believe in it, don't stress it or sometimes even mention it. And one reason for that is that you shouldn't think that you have another chance. We shouldn't live our lives with the awareness that we might have a chance to make it up later, because then we might not do our best this time around. So, and I think that's definitely a risk for those who are less learned, but who are understand enough to understand that there is reincarnation. They might come to a place where they think, oh, what's the difference? I'll do what I want now, and I can always come back, fix it up later. Which, of course, doesn't mean you'll want to fix it up in that time coming back. But when I spoke to Rabbi Rieti, so it seems that reincarnation is dependent on two things. One is your merit, and one is your need. So reincarnation is available for those who need it and those who merit it. So it would be somebody who's kind of right in between, somebody who's done enough positive things that they deserve to have another go-around. And at the same time, that person has to have not done enough that they need to have a second go-around, both together. So somebody who's done completely bad doesn't get another chance. And somebody who's done completely good, or mostly good, also doesn't need a second chance. And it doesn't mean that there's only one time of reincarnation. There could be more than one. But the point is, it's only for those who need it and merit it at the same time. That being said, there's another important factor of reincarnation that's not discussed here, but I learned elsewhere, that it's very uncomfortable to be reincarnated. It's not an easy experience to go through. It can make for a difficult life or difficult parts of life. So that being said, it seems, and I'm not sure what the source is on this, I've just heard that the last new soul born into the world was the Vilna Gaon. And from then on, it's all been reincarnations. So that basically all of us today are those people who both need it and merit it at the same time, which seems to be one reason why life can be more challenging for many of us today. And who knows if it really is more challenging or if it isn't, but it seems like it is, certainly from our points of view, more challenging than maybe previous people had. But that could be because we're actually... and put that together with the line of history. If you look at the timeline of history and what's going on and what's unfolding, it does seem that we're very close to the end. The more one learns about Jewish history and the more one learns about signs for the end, for Yemot Mashiach, for the end of days, that we're getting closer and closer and closer, there is a limit. There is a limit to this world and how it's going to be. So we do have a concept of each day of creation is a miniature of one of each of the six millennia. So that we are right now at 5772. We're in the sixth millennium, so that this day parallels Friday, the sixth day. So that the end of Friday is candle lighting, when Shabbos begins. So there is a deadline to finish everything by. So that right now, if it's 5772, that means we're three quarters of the way through the sixth, which means that it's, if you think about Friday as a day, three quarters of the way through is when time is speeding up and we're getting closer and closer to Shabbos and we're going a little faster, trying to get things done. So we do see time around us. We see time speeding up. Everything seems to be going faster and faster, and things need to get done. So for that reason, we have many people, whether it's all or just many, there are reincarnations now that are trying to finish things up, tie up loose ends, make the tikkunim that they need to make, complete the growth that they need to complete, but everything has to get done. The time is closing in, and hopefully we'll get to make an early Shabbos. We won't have to wait till the very end, till the very last minute. And that's dependent on many different factors. But let's say it is an early Shabbos. It means we really do have a lot to finish up pretty quickly. So that's one of the reasons that the world seems like it's in the shape that it's in, with everything kind of in a tumult. Hopefully it will all be woven together very nicely into Kabbalat Shabbat very soon. But meanwhile, we have this concept of reincarnation. Okay, so this discussion of reincarnation is within our discussion of individual providence, of Hashgacha Ha'ishit, as he calls it. So that's the context that we're seeing it in. So it has to do with how our lives are structured. So let's look back in the text. When an individual has a reincarnated soul, it is possible that he will be affected in a particular manner as a result of his deeds in a previous incarnation. The situation in which he is placed may follow from this, and this situation may bring with it the special responsibility given to him, as discussed earlier. So early in the chapter, we talked about all the different reasons that life may be set up the way that it's set up, and hopefully we'll review those soon. But one of the factors may be the life that one has led previously. Or, since Hashem is not bound by time and there's no past, present, and future for Hashem, our lives may be set up to set us up for a future incarnation, so that we need to go through whatever we're going through now to fix up the next life, should we need it. So the calculations are very complicated. Excuse me, but this is just explaining why our life might look like it does right now. What are all the various reasons that go into that? So one of the possible reasons is reincarnation. Excuse me.
Can I just ask a question?
Yep.
If there's no concept of time with Hashem, then what's this whole idea of us finishing off the work? Why can't it be regulated over all the six millennia?
Right. It is. Welcome to whoever just joined. I'm guessing that it's Suri, because she muted herself right away. So welcome. So we have a concept of time. Time is part of the creation. Hashem created time so that we have a sense of linear experience moving from past into present into future, so that we can arrange our lives that way. We need that. So it can't be for us, just because of the way that we're created, we can't be all over the place all the time. Only Hashem can. So there is a time, there is a concept of us finishing off the work, but we're not finishing off Hashem's work. We're finishing off our work. For Hashem, it's already Yemos HaMashiach, and it's way back before Adam HaRishon, and it's the Inquisition, and it's the days of the Beis HaMikdash, and it's the future all at the same time. So it's all happening at once for Hashem, which is one reason why Hashem knows everything. There is no time. So he already knows the decision that you're about to make, because he's already passed you in making that, which doesn't mean that you can't make the decision that you're not free to decide, but he already knows what it is because there is no time. It's not like he has to wait to find out. So that already exists for him. But we, nevertheless, have the work that we have to do. So we still have to work on creating ourselves. Excuse me, I had pineapple for dinner and I'm a little bit allergic. I shouldn't have had it. And somebody's calling me. Hang on one second.
Donnie, I'm teaching right now, honey.
Okay. So we still have to go from our beginning to our middle to our end. And our end is making the most of what we have. So we're all given our basic resources that we have to work with to become who we need to be. So who we are is only the distance between how we come into the world and how we exit it. So we have to go through linear time in order to create accomplishment, to create who we are. So if we're created in the image of Shem, one of those images being creator, and if we're gifted with being able to create human beings, like Hashem is, then the principal human that we create, excuse me, is ourselves. We, as mothers, facilitate the creation of other human beings as well, both physically, emotionally, spiritually, so it's more than both, but in many different levels. But our principal human being that we're responsible for creating is us. But that requires a linear time experience. And then there's the world, too. So not only do we have to perfect ourselves, but we have to perfect the world. So the world goes through its different stages. So there is a sense of time, and there is a sense of things that need to be finished up before the world can reach its next stage of development.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer that question?
Right.
Do you have a follow-up question on that?
No.
So we do have a sense of linear time, and there is what to finish up. So some of the things that need to be finished up right now are the fulfillment of many of the prophecies that are given in the Torah. So we, for instance, do see, we see Kibbutz Galiot right now, that the return of the exiles from all the different lands going back to the land of Israel. We don't yet see a Torah government in the land of Israel. We don't yet see the return of the Beis HaMikdash. We don't yet see people observing the Torah, the bulk of the Jewish people. We don't yet see the non-Jews coming to the Jews to learn Torah. We see little tiny threads of that, but we're not yet at the place of Bayom Hahu Yeh Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad. We're still waiting for that, but we are seeing threads being stitched together as some of those prophecies are being revealed, and so more of that has to happen, and the whole world is turning. I mean, it's fascinating to see how history is unfolding, but certainly, and I guess there would be argument about this, but it seems to me that the current state of Israel, the fact that Jews are moving in from around the world, is a beginning of the end. So that, I mean, from a non-Zionistic point of view, just the concept that so many Jews are coming together from around the world and are trying to keep Torah in the land of Israel in a way that hasn't happened since the Chorban does mean a shift in the way things are happening, and things are being set up for the ultimate end. So, but we're threatened. Right, so we're going to have to take care of Iran, whether we do it or whether Hashem does it or whether a different agent of Hashem does it, that will have to happen. And we'll have to see, like, how there's supposed to be a fight, ultimately, between the Christians and the Muslims, between the Yishma'elim and the Edomim, right? So Edom is basically Christian today, and the Yishma'elim, which are basically Muslim today. So there is supposed to be an end-of-days war between them, and we'll have to see if we have to experience that or not, and what that causes in the world. I don't know exactly, and can it be a war that can be fulfilled in other ways? I'm trying to think. Earlier in the book, we discussed something about about the destruction of the world Right. I'm trying to think where that was. There is a concept of the destruction of the necessity of the world to be destroyed before the Messianic era, before the actual time of the Mashiach can be, not like the era of Mashiach time that we're in. But one of the thoughts about how the world might be destroyed so that we don't have to worry so much about bloodshed and war is that it could be destroyed ideologically. And we see that happening around us right now, that the ideas of the past are being destroyed. What makes a family? What makes a good leader? What defines obedience? What defines leadership? All of that is being destroyed. And we'll just see if that's enough destruction, if having the world as we know it through ideas being destroyed and rebuilt is the destruction that's been prophesied, or if we need a physical destruction as well. But we might not need a physical destruction. Just like, for instance, some of the prophecies say that some of the exiles will be brought on the wings of eagles back to the land of Israel, and certainly the Yemenite Jews thought of that prophecy when they were airlifted out in the bellies of planes, and they had never seen a plane in their life, right? And a plane just landed and opened up, and everybody climbed inside and flew off to the land of Israel. I mean, for them, it was straight up from the pages of the Torah. You know, they were carried on the wings of eagles back to the land of Israel. I heard a story of how, you know, these planes, these were huge cargo planes that were emptied out. No seats, no anything, just so they could cram in as many people as possible. And they were flying. It was a long flight. The pilots flew there, and they loaded everybody up, flew back. Somebody knocked on the cabin door and offered the pilot a cup of hot coffee. And he said, oh, thanks. And then he realized, hot coffee? Where did that come from? Somebody had made a fire in the middle of the plane. So they had no clue what they were doing. Anyway, so who knows? I mean, that can be a way that a prophecy is revealed. We don't know what it's going to actually be like. Wings of eagles could be airplanes, and destruction of the world could be ideological destruction of the world. We don't know what it's going to be like until we look back and see, oh, yeah, that's what it is. Meanwhile, that is why there has to be some kind of linear thing. We do have what to finish up, and there are prophecies left to be revealed, and there's things left to be learned by the world, how we can work together, or how to make things work, how to utilize things, how to maximize things, or possibly even humanity needs to get to a place where we're so efficient in everything that or Western civilization has to get to a place where we're so efficient, we're working such long days, and we realize, for what? It could be that we all have to get to a place as a society to realize that we're working far too much for far too little, and that we need Shabbos, we need a break, we need a family, we need whatever it is, that we have to get there experientially before the time of Shabbos can come to the world. Okay, back to the text. There are many details in the concept of reincarnation involving the manner in which an individual is judged according to one incarnation and how this judgment depends on previous incarnations. The crucial point, however, is the fact that all is truly fair and just. As the Torah states, the Creator's work is perfect, all his ways are justice. No created thing can encompass God's thoughts or the profound depth of his plan. We only know that, like all other such concepts, the principle of reincarnation as one of man's experiences also follows the rule of fair judgment as decreed by God to perfect mankind in general. So, basically, this paragraph is, there is reincarnation. It does either explain why certain things, why we're experiencing certain things in this life because of a past life, or why we might be experiencing things, certain things in this life to set us up for a next life, and also that we're judged on each incarnation separately, and then we're judged in the aggregate at the end of all incarnations. Okay, any more questions on reincarnation for now?
I'm so curious, like, how do souls work, like, in terms of reincarnations?
good. I'm going to give you a soul theory that is based on what I've learned, but I haven't ever seen it written quite like this. So I can't give it anybody else's title. You just have to know that this is a theory. But I'll tell you why. I'll explain to you how I arrived at my theory. So we have a concept that there is one soul of all humanity. That's the soul of Adam. And then that soul was divided into two when Chava was pulled from him. Now you have Adam and Chava, two halves of the one soul of all of humanity, which explains why each one of us still today is both suffering the consequences of their avera and also has the power to be metaken their avera. So, for instance, when we take challah from the dough, we don't usually teach this. We have to be careful. I think I mentioned this in different class. We don't teach this, but we could think. We don't teach it because it could be too inflammatory, but we could think to ourselves, Chava kilkila et chalato shel ha'olam. Chava messed up the challah of the world. Adam is called the challah of the world. He's the reason for the world's existence. And was put, if you think about the whole world being finished, like a ball of dough is finished, and then Hashem pulled out that piece of earth and made it into Adam, so Adam is like the challah of the world. Everything follows the reshis. Challah is called reshis, or reshit, depending on how you pronounce things. So, chava kilkala et chalato shel ha'olam. When we, females, take challah today, we are metaken the kilkul that Chava made when she was kilkala, the challah of the world. So each time we take challah, we're metaken the chet Chava. Okay, so that's the first soul. Then they had whatever kids they had, and the soul splintered out into the whole world. We will discuss further, but we've discussed previously how the Jewish people separated off. Excuse me, but first of all, the entire world, every single person in the world comes from the one soul of Adam and Chava. And then we have a separate Jewish soul that was separated off, so we're not going to review that right now, how that happened, but a separate Jewish soul. But we do have a concept from our Torah sources that there were 600,000 souls present at Matan Torah, and that's how many Jewish souls there are, 600,000 Jewish souls, period. So we know that at Matan Torah, according to Midrashim, there were approximately 3 million Jews receiving the Torah, even right then at that time. 3 million Jews, because there are 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60, and then their wives, the elders that were above 60, and the children that were below 20, so of both genders. So we have approximately 3 million people who received the Torah, and yet we have this concept that there were only 600,000 souls at the time, and that that's the total amount of Jewish souls, 600,000. So, and we know for sure that there's many more than 600,000 Jews who've ever existed, because if it's 600,000 souls, period, and then if you start from, let's start counting Jews from Abraham and Sarah. So if you start from Abraham and Sarah, you could still count them. It's possible to count them until they go into Mitzrayim. Coming out is harder to count them, and however many died during the plague of darkness also, but go from Abraham and Sarah all the way until the end of time, past us today, go through the future, Bayit Rishon, Bayit Sheni, into the long exile, these last 2,000 years, and then keep going past us until the end of days, till every last Jew has been born, right? That's how many Jews there are. How many is that? I don't know. But it's a lot more than 600,000. And there's reincarnations. Excuse me. So with reincarnations, we also, I'll just make your question a little bit more problematic. With reincarnations, we also have problems of when there's Tchias Mesim, which body will you be Mechayed in, right? So if you're Rivka in this life and you're a Malka 3 lives ago, and if you're going to be Rose in 2 lives, so after, when Chesed Mesim comes, who are you, Rivka, Malka, or Rose? And not only that, whose wife are you? Right? Are you Max's wife, Rose? Or are you Shloimeh's wife, Rivka? Or Ben-Sion's wife, Malka? Right? So who and whose souls are you tied to forever? So making these questions, adding it all in. So this is now we're starting. So that's all information that's not my theory. Now I'll tell you my theory based on all that information so far. We have the concept of reincarnation of 600,000 souls, and we have the problem of all these Jews. So we definitely have the concept, okay, this is still before my theory, we definitely have the concept of soul chips, soul splinters, right, that each of those 600,000 souls must be, let's say, choppable into multiple parts so that each one of us could have a piece, right? Even the 3 million who stood at Sinai all had to have just a piece of a soul. Let's say each one had a fifth of a soul, so that way you do the math, and 5 times 600,000, so you get to 30, so that's 3 million. So if each one had one-fifth of a soul, you get the right number for the people who were there at the time. However, it's much bigger than that. So what, people have a hundredth of a soul, a thousandth of a soul? Is that what we are? We're all walking around with 1,000th of a soul? So that's possible, but this now starts my theory. I believe that if you take the 600,000 souls that we know that there are, and then take the number of Jews from Avraham and Sarah until the end of time, and now I'm just picking a number. Let's say you take that number and multiply it by 10. And then take that number and divide it into the 600,000. So you get a lot of soul splinters. Enough for each Jew from the beginning of Jews until the end of Jews to have 10 soul splinters each. So now think about each person as a stack of splinters. So reincarnation could be a rearrangement of that stack. It doesn't mean that the stack of 10 that you're holding right now is the same stack of 10 that was Malki 2 lifetimes ago. It could be that what you have right now is 2 of Malki and 1 of Malki's sisters and 4 of Malki's mother all mixed up, and 1 of Malki's worst enemy or best friend, all mixed up into you right now. So that your job is to be metaken those chips somehow. There's also, just let me add into this theory for getting complicated here, there is a concept that Rav Dessler discusses of family souls. That each family has a concept of neshama, and that with the family soul, it's each one of our job to be, to contribute to and to be metaken the family job and role, which is one reason why family members look like each other, because we do look something like our soul. Our soul projects an energy that causes our looks. So if we look similar to our family members or similar to somebody who's not a family member, it does point us towards a concept of similar soul journey. Doesn't mean it's the same, but similar or partnered soul journey. So let's say in a family, Rav Dessler explains, that's one reason why a family member inherits the looks of another, because they have a similar soul, but that's one reason why they also inherit the stuff of another. Stuff here being both physical and emotional. So a child will inherit from a parent the parent's physical belongings, and also the parent's emotional baggage. So we see that clearly, let's say, with Holocaust survivors, how that passes down to the generations. But it's not just that. We see it with other things too. Empowerment, drive for education, drive for success, shallowness, depth. Those kinds of things can be passed on from generation to generation. And it's very complicated, of course. It all has to do with all these things that we're learning. But a person can inherit the psychic package of their parents, as well as the physical package. as well as the way that they look. All of that comes together because the family has an neshama, that each person in the family is responsible for shepherding their piece of through. Now, all that being said, let's back into the Elisa Bulow theory of souls and how that works. So for all soul stacks, then we could imagine that each person has 10 soul chips that might be rearranged differently and might be actually different in each incarnation of each person. And then based on the principle also that Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Lazeh, all Jews are interconnected one with another, so then we also have the one way of the interconnection can be that these soul stacks mix up upon reincarnation, so that we actually are each other in a way, because we share soul pieces, and we all go back to that initial 600,000 souls, which really goes back to the Abraham and Sarah single Jewish soul that's been splintered into the 600,000 that's been splintered into all of us. Now, one more piece that I would say, as long as I'm advancing my own theory here of soul stacks, is that if we're thinking about each one of us having 10 slices in a soul stack, I think it's possible that we don't all have 10, that some may have 3, and some may have 27, and some may have 110, some may even have 1. That doesn't mean that there's an equal distribution of the number of soul chips that each person has, just that if you're a Jew, you have Jewish-only soul chips. And even in terms of my own theory, I haven't really thought about or worked out where converts come into this. In this particular one, certainly we have the concept of conversion in Judaism, as you know, and souls can be transformed into being Jewish, which we'll see coming up in the Ramchal, probably next week or the week after. Souls can become Jewish, but there is also a concept in reincarnation of sometimes a Jewish soul, or possibly, that's what I'm saying, I don't know for sure, possibly a part, let's say a few chips of some Jewish souls being trapped in a non-Jewish body, and then that non-Jew having to undergo a conversion process to, in a way, to redeem those pieces and reunite them back with the Jewish people. So there are several theories of conversion and how that works. But so anyway, that's one way I'd say that's an answer, and we can't know the answer, but an answer that probably confuses you more now of how souls work and how reincarnation works would be this mixed up stack of souls or soul chips that each person might carry and then have the responsibility while they hold them to fix them and add to them, develop them and fix them with the best of their ability in the circumstances that they're presented with in this go-through, this pass-through of the world.
So what happens eventually, that is not clear. Which soul do we go back to?
Okay, yeah. So as we'll see as we learn more deeply, the concepts that we've learned previously, the concept of soulmate, that the Gemara in Nida talks about one soul that's then torn in half. It's created as one because it's created in the image of Hashem. And then that soul is torn in half. Half is sent into a male body and half is sent into a female body. And then hopefully 20 years or so after they're born, they find each other and they found their soulmate. So that's a lovely thought. And that is a first layer thought for us. But it turns out that there's not an ultimate soulmate. There is that concept on some level, but really, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Lazeh, which is the fundamental principles we discussed earlier of Kiruv, the reason why we do Kiruv, the reason why we care about each and every Jew being safe and part of us, but safe spiritually and intellectually also, part of the Jewish people and knowing as much as we can about Torah, each one of us, is because we are all each other, and we're so connected. So one's husband is not it is their primary arena. Their marriage and their home is their primary arena for avoda in this lifetime. And we do create a special connection with our spouse, and yet ultimately that special connection is about how do we grow ourselves individually and facilitate in the growth of the others in our orbit so that eventually our souls are all part of, initially part of that perfected community, but really we're trying to create an ahad. So we want everyone to be able to contribute to that ahadness if possible with as much as they have to contribute to it. So we, in our microcosm of our marriage, while we're constrained in these finite physical bodies, we want to do our best with what we have to try to create the concept of one in our marriage and blend those two soul halves. And we should think about it on that level, but then we also need to know that it's on a much deeper level and that ultimately the dvekas that we're trying to achieve is dvekas' total connection, and the dvekas is to Hashem. So we want a total connection to Hashem. And the less our ego is involved and the more we connect to Hashem, the more real we become and the more permanent we become. So it's a long process and kind of difficult to understand, but it turns out that not the sublimation of the self creates that connection, but the realization of self in a Jewish way creates that total dvekas with Hashem. And then that leads to the ultimate realization of self through total attachment to Hashem and release from the physical bond. So there's the total attachment. So I know I've discussed this concept with a friend of mine before who's in her 70s who admits that she has a strong ego and she finds this extremely difficult to swallow. She doesn't want to share her achievements with others, and she doesn't want to share her victories or her failures. She doesn't want anybody to be blamed for her failures either. So she feels strongly that she wants to maintain a sense of self after death. And it's hard for her to wrap her mind around. I think it's hard for a lot of people to wrap their minds around. But while I believe there is probably a sense of self immediately after death, immediately meaning the whatever period that is, whether it's a year or a few years or some kind of time after death where immediately at death there is a concept, even in Torah, of being, but certainly in the wider world, of being greeted by one's departed relatives as they cross over to the other side, of a sense of comfort by seeing those people again. Those people are waiting to guide you into the next world, but ultimately they're not your relatives. Ultimately, it's not your, there is that blend into the wholeness of the Jewish people, and there's not the distinct imagery anymore, and it's not necessary for there to be that distinct imagery. So, the ultimate thing that happens is a blending.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really know how that works. But ultimately there is a blending. There's not the distinct personalities anymore. But that's after a while. So what is that while? I don't know.
So we're back to the one soul that we all originated from?
I think we do go back eventually, but it's a different one soul. And I'm not sure how long that takes. If that takes all of the Messianic era, if that takes even beyond that, there certainly is a concept of reward and punishment that is individual for each person who has strived, each set of souls, the soul chips and how they're seen. But ultimately, I think that ultimately in the distant future, there is a level of return. According to, there must be something distinct that one still feels according to what they've achieved, because it's not like you just blend into the whole and it doesn't matter that you worked harder than somebody else. It can't be that somebody can slack off, eat treif, never daven, not just tznius, hang out, do whatever they feel like, and in the end they get the same treatment as the one who really worked hard on themselves, who learned Torah regularly, who guarded their tongue, who tried to be as kind and as giving as possible. It can't be that it's the same. And yet, ultimately, after all things, after reward and after, I'm not exactly sure how it works, but there's a concept of being directed towards the one. But I think that has to do with how much can you be directed, how much benefit can you get from the dvekas, has to do with what you've been able to achieve. Mm-hmm. But there is a level of dvaikas. So I would say, I guess, maybe if you think about being connected through a membrane, and that membrane, if thinking about, let's say, cellular osmosis, that the membrane is what is the barrier between the one creature and the next. And as we connect to Hashem, we're connected on. And there's a membrane. So for some, the membrane will be thinner, and for some, it will be thicker. The ability to absorb from Hashem directly will somehow be affected by what we have achieved in this world. And I'm not exactly sure how that gets to the oneness in the end. But there certainly is that extremely long intermediate period of individual dvaikus before the whole connected part. Any other questions about reincarnation?
I think I have to digest it and then see.
Hannah, how about you?
No, I appreciate the thoughts that you have on your theory. Very intriguing. I've never really had much of a problem with reincarnation. That's one of the things that drew me to Orthodox Judaism, is that, you know, there is this concept in that, and I was comfortable with that before.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever wonder how it worked?
I guess I kind of, in my own way, have my own theories, and it's kind of a unity theory and a certain reflection of yours, based on how Adam, you know, they started out with Cain and Hevel, and there was the murder, and then there was Cain and Chase, and according to some genealogies, the Cain's daughter Nama married Noah. So
right.
We have the gene pool coming back together again.
Right.
From all aspects. And then we have them having Chase, Yafet, and Ham. And I think in the end it's all going to come back together as one somehow. I don't exactly know
mm-hmm.
how that's going to be, but I think they all share a common goal, so to speak, in it bringing a oneness to the humanity as a whole.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in the end we are going to see a oneness that's an incredible oneness that's hard to understand at this point because we live in a world of pirud, of separation.
Yeah.
But I think when it says Bayom Hahu Yeh Hashem Achad Ushmo Achad, it's so much more than Hashem. I mean, it is Hashem because everything is. We all live in Hashem. Hashem is Ha'am
yeah,
Akom.
Yeah, yeah.
So that the oneness will be such an intense oneness that everything will be one, I think.
That will
but
still
it will
be
in layers.
Within that one?
I think there will be initially. Will there still be individuals in that one?
But if you think about the Torah, people are individuals. If you think about the Ovis and all that.
Right, for sure. So I think initially there's going to be individuality like there is now. And then there's going to be layers of revelation of oneness. So just like now, I would say that this whole one world phenomenon, you know, the fact that the world is getting so small that we can just talk, you know, right now, the three of us so far apart so easily, there's no time delay even. You know, just the fact that technology is unifying the world in that way is one layer of oneness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the fact that commerce is so universal today that you really can't have the economy of one country collapse and it not affect other countries. That and you certainly, in terms of pollution, you can't. I mean, America is so busy exporting its, you know, industry to China, thinking that they're being more green here in America because they don't do those negative environmental practices. Meanwhile, China's spewing all that pollution into the world. It's the same world.
Right,
you know,
right.
And so we are one world, and I think that we are recognizing that today and seeing that today, feeling the impact of it today in a way that we never felt before. Email and YouTube and whatever it is unites us so much all around the globe that is a layer of oneness. And so I think we will start to appreciate layer after layer after layer of oneness being revealed, whether it's in economy or in environment or in government eventually or in religious concepts, in education, in achievement, in synergy. So it's going to be layer after layer after layer until the whole world comes to a one God concept where we all refer to God in the same way and understand the God the same way. And then it's just going to keep going past that. That'll be Yemot HaMashiach, and then we'll keep going past that. Eventually, however, I think we are going to lose individuality, but not while we're in bodies and not while we're walking on the earth. That's going to be after. I mean, we still, according to the Ramchal, after Techeyas HaMesim and then a re-death, then there's still a reunification of an ethereal body with the soul. But even in that ethereal body, I think that's in that he feels is eternal. I don't know exactly what happens at that point, you know, further on down that road after Techeyas HaMesim, when we begin eternity, which we haven't yet begun. I think somewhere along that road there's going to be some kind of transformation from individual to collective at some point, but not in this, not on this earth, in this kind of a flesh heavy body.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's probably enough for this week.
Guess
we're not doing 11 and 12 yet. So we'll save 11 and 12 for next week, which I hope I'll be able to make. I'm going to be in Oregon next week, but I don't currently have plans for 6 o'clock in Portland. So maybe I'll be able to do it then. I guess I'll send an email if I can't. So check your emails if I'll have to cancel it. But Be'ezrat Hashem, I'll be able to do it at the same time next week, and we'll continue with 11 and 12 and hopefully finish up this chapter.
Okay, thank you so much.
Have
Lovely.
A great
thank
week.
Thank you very much.
Okay, call
good
two.
Night.
Okay, good
bye-bye.
Night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.